Hey there. Welcome to another edition of the Livewire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank. You know, one of the things I've really missed during the pandemic has been live performances. Like, I would honestly go to someone doing bad karaoke at a bar right now if I could, just to kind of scratch that itch. And even though we're not quite back at the point where we can get together in person for this show, we are going to spend the next hour talking about the art of live performance. First up with filmmaker Andrea Nevins, whose new documentary, Hysterical, celebrates women in stand-up comedy. Then we're going to be chatting with writer Hanif Abdul-Raqib about his new book, which looks at how Black performance of all kinds has impacted American culture. And then our pal Shaky Graves is going to join us from Austin to talk about his attempts at being an actor before he decided to focus on music. Please make your way back to your seat and get comfy, because it's almost showtime. Livewire gets started right after this. This episode of Livewire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
It is going really well this week. From where I'm sitting here in my house in Portland, Oregon, I can see a variety of cherry blossoms that are just hitting their kind of peak. And it's so beautiful, but I'm also a little sad because it's a short time offer. And now I'm thinking about how those blooms aren't going to be there pretty soon.
Now you're thinking about when there will no longer be pedicle elongation.
What does that mean?
You know, the cherry blossoms that surround the Potomac in D.C., you always want to get there at the perfect moment where they've all bloomed and it's just like snowing pink. And the watch lists look for things called pedicle elongation.
That's peak cherry blossom. That's that just like perfect moment between when they're sort of blossoming and before they start withering. That's pedicle elongation. Are you ready to do some public radio elongation?
I am pedicle. Yes. The answer is yes.
This is going to be peak public radio variety recorded from home. Molly, are we recording?
You know, I think we are.
All right. Take it away, Elena.
From PRX, it's Livewire. Recorded from our actual houses. Welcome to the Livewire House Party. This week, filmmaker Andrea Nevins and writer Hanif Abdul-Raqib, with music from Shaky Graves. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now, the host of Livewire, Luke Burbank!
Thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We have, I think, a really good show in store for everyone this week. Of course, we always like to ask the Livewire listeners a question. This week, because we're talking a lot about performance, we asked the listeners, what's the most memorable performance you have ever seen? And we're going to be hearing those answers coming up in just a little bit. First, though, of course, we got to start with the best news we heard this week. It's our little weekly reminder that there is good news happening out there in the world all the time. I'd like to highlight some of that. Elena, what is the best news you heard this week?
Oh, Luke, are you ready?
I'm ready.
I don't know if you're ready. I don't know if you're ready for this one. It's almost too cute. This takes place in, I believe, Duplin County, North Carolina, where there was a stray dog who's now named Sisu, who got picked up at the Dollar General because he had broken into the Dollar General not one, not two, not three, not four, but five times. And every single time, he stole the exact same purple stuffed unicorn toy. And he just would stride right in and take his toy. And they're like, that's not yours. And so when animal control came to take him to a shelter, the animal control worker, her name is Officer Lane, bought the unicorn for Sisu. And then when he went to the shelter, he got to sit with it in his cage. Happy ending. Number one, Sisu is up for adoption, and there's tons of applications for him, so he is going to have a wonderful forever home. And number two, there is a picture of this dog with this unicorn, and it's this huge stuffed animal and the cutest dog you've ever seen. He's just one of those dogs that has one of those faces where you go, oh, it's a good boy.
Aw. I think I saw a picture of this on the internet, and yeah, it's just one of those things. Like, if you're looking at a picture of Sisu and Sisu's purple unicorn toy and you don't smile, immediately go to the hospital.
Check your pulse.
There's something that is going on, because it is the most adorable picture of all time. Speaking of things that are, I think, kind of adorable, the best news I saw this week the big news was that they managed to get that huge container ship that was stuck in the Suez Canal.
Yes, the Ever Given.
They managed to get it unstuck.
Yeah.
But this was the really cool thing. They had all these tugboats in the Suez Canal that were working to try to get this thing free. And when they finally did, one of the tugs, it's called the Mashhur. That's how you pronounce the name of this Egyptian tug. The dudes on the tug were so excited that they had gotten the Ever Given free that they just started on this impromptu chant. They're chanting Mashhur is number one.
Yeah. It's like a sport now.
Yeah. And it's like one dude is just filming this on his cell phone. They're like up on the like very tippy top of the tugboat. And I mean, you could just tell that they're obviously super excited and that they were sort of part of, you know, getting the, you know, trade, one of the major trading routes in the entire planet open again. Like, that's a big deal.
Yeah. And, you know, I think some of the photos don't show exactly how big the Ever Given is, but Pittsburghers put it for scale up against Steelers Stadium, where the Steelers play, Heinz Field. And it's like all of the parking lots long from one major highway artery, like all the way to the river. And so a little tippy teeny weeny tugboat that can do that work, they must have just felt like superheroes.
I also have to say, just on a personal note, I've talked on this show many times about how bad I've been at driving boats. This thing made me feel like me crashing my boat into three other boats in the marina back when I had one. This whole thing made me feel like a lot better about my maritime skills. So maybe that for me is the best news that I heard this week. All right, let's invite our first guest on over to this house party. She is the filmmaker behind this new documentary, Hysterical, which is about the history and also the future of women in stand-up comedy. This film premiered at this year's South by Southwest Festival. It's also out right now on FX and Hulu. Let's welcome Andrea Nevins over to the Livewire house party.
So happy to be here. Couldn't be happier.
What got you interested in this topic in the first place?
You know, I had just finished a documentary about Barbie, Tiny Shoulders, and I had done a deep dive into looking at the past 60 years of women in feminism. Barbie was born at the very beginning of the second wave of feminism, and I was not done exploring and was looking for a way to look out ahead. Where was feminism going? Mm. And there's no more interesting place, I think, than in the world of stand-up, because those are the people who really push boundaries and kind of get us to the very end of what we're allowed to talk about, what we're allowed to think about. And so that seemed like a cool place to go and explore.
You profile a bunch of different comedians who are women in this film, and they have sort of wildly different backgrounds. I'm wondering if there's like a through line that you started to pick up as the director in their experience that kind of got them to being stand-up comics?
Well, as Fortune very clearly says, damage.
Right.
But I think that there's not any of us who couldn't find some element of damage in our childhood that changed our courses in some way.
Yeah, we all act out in different ways just for some of us, it's talking into a microphone.
Exactly. And for some of us, it's hiding behind a camera and making movies and telling stories. So you can figure out what my damage was. But all of these women really found a need to express themselves on stage. And in that very unique, I think, frightening way of being all alone on stage without a director, without other actors, and even for them, without props. So I began to see them really as superheroes, just really so brave to get up there against all odds.
I mean, hopefully things are changing and evolving a little bit here in 2021, but a lot of the comedians that you interview in this film, they got started, 10 years, sometimes 20 years ago. What was the experience like for them as they described it to you of starting out, you know, in the 80s of trying to be a woman doing stand-up comedy?
It was fairly terrifying and dreadful in a multitude of ways, from demeaning introductions to not being able to get up on stage at all because, for example, a club owner might say, oh, you know, we had a woman on a couple of weeks ago and she really didn't do very well, so we're not having any
women. Yeah, it's like Judy Gold, I think, is saying in the film that somebody said to her, 3 months ago, we had a woman at this club and it didn't go well. Like, I've been in stand-up comedy clubs. If a man having a bad stand-up comedy set meant there couldn't be any more men for 3 months, there would be, like, no men in the comedy club.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was really shocked just going out and shooting marquees, you know, as B-roll, and seeing man, woman. Mm-hmm. And I think that all those women are still finding that. So that's a hard thing to come up against as well. And then in addition, I think it's just a very different thing for women to be on the road alone. One of the things that you have to do to become an excellent stand-up comedian is practice, practice, practice. And a great way to practice is to go out outside of your home city and get stage time. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of these women, it meant, and they're very funny about it, arriving and getting picked up by right. somebody who feels like a serial killer, or you know, people following you to a kind of dreary hotel and banging on the door all night. It's scary to be a woman alone traveling in the United States. Mm-hmm. It still is.
This is LiveWire Radio. We're talking to Andrea Nevins about her film Hysterical on FX, which is a documentary about women in stand-up comedy. We've been sort of talking about the challenging side of it, but this film also is really funny and has a lot of like great stories about why it is that the women that you talk to in the film love this art form and sort of need to do it. And I want to get into that right after this short break. Stay with us. It's LiveWire House Party from PRX.
Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions. Oh my, there's so much going on. Get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Go to ZBiotics.com/LiveWire to get 15% off your first order when you use LiveWire at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/LiveWire and use the code LiveWire at checkout for 15% off. Thank you to ZBiotics for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
Welcome back to the LiveWire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We are talking to Andrea Nevins, the director of Hysterical, a documentary on FX that interviews and follows the sort of performance and the lives of a number of women doing stand-up comedy. Have you ever done stand-up comedy yourself, Andrea? Were you ever tempted as like a method directing when making this?
You're violently shaking your head.
Never, no, absolutely not. No, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. And that when the way that what these women do is really just to me, the scariest thing I can imagine short of jumping out of an airplane. So that just describes who I am.
Nikki Glaser has a line, the comedian Nikki Glaser has a line in the beginning of the film, I think, where she says, women have an advantage in comedy because we've been in our feelings forever. Is there any truth to that?
I think there's 100% truth in that. I do think that women have been brought up with a lot of negatives, but one of the positives is that we've been taught to be attuned to our feelings. And when you can name things in a very precise way, that's often the source of a lot of comedy. It's when you're when you as an audience member are shocked that somebody just revealed a truth that you hadn't even been able to name yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think these women have that in spades. They're really just gifted.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the film was a kind of a moment to reflect on like the history of women in stand-up comedy and people like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, and also the insane tightrope that they were walking, mm-hmm. Because of just how things were framed, you know, back in their day.
Yeah, there's this moment where Phyllis Diller's being interviewed by a bunch of men,
right?
And they're just shocked, first of all, that she's willing to get up there and talk, but also terrified that she's a man basher, mm-hmm. and that's the only way that a woman can find humor in the world is by tearing men down. And she has to assure them that no. The only reason why I could do this is because I love men so much.
Right. And like Moms Mabley, I learned in this film, you know, part of her kind of costume on stage was to be dressed very sort of in a house coat and seeming more elderly than she really was to kind of blunt the effect of the actual satire that she was putting out.
Time and time again, in those early days of women doing stand-up, they had to subvert any femininity. Mm-hmm. They had to be anti-sexual, mm-hmm. Which is fascinating. So Moms did it by dressing like a granny, and Phyllis Diller did it by making her hair crazy. Right. And everybody found ways to make it so that you would be paying attention to the funny and not to the body, which I found a very interesting thing, because there's this idea that that if men are in the audience, the first thing they're going to be thinking about is not how funny she is, but how cute she is, or right. whether he might want to go to bed with her. And so they had to blunt that. And it's taken a long time for women to get past that in the audience eyes.
And I had this flashback to another documentary that I watched that addressed women in country music, when you had that montage of all these different late night talk show hosts introducing Joan Rivers as like my daffy little quirky little tiny little cute, and then with Dolly Parton it was like here's this little lady, you know, like Porter Wagoner or whatever. And even the way that they're introduced is diminutive and dismissive across these industries. It was a real kind of connective moment.
Isn't it surprising? And when you get to see it and not just talk about it, it's that much more shocking.
I had also never heard that Jerry Lee Lewis clip of, what year was that, that Jerry Lee Lewis said what he said about women can't be funny?
There were a couple of different references to it, and one was early on, and one was, I think, as recently as in the 70s.
Unbelievable.
I know,
yeah.
Right?
That woke the dog up.
Yeah, like, just for folks who haven't seen the film yet, this is Jerry Lewis basically saying he doesn't think women can be funny. And then there was an interesting part in the film, Andrea. By the way, we're talking to Andrea Nivens about her film Hysterical, where you're interviewing Eliza Schlesinger, and you ask a question that Eliza Schlesinger interprets to be a version of, why do people think women can't be funny? And Eliza says to you, I thought we weren't going to talk about that. I'm curious, why was that question something that you weren't supposed to talk about?
Time and time again, when we reached out to women comedians, they said, I will not be part of a documentary that rehashes that awful way of thinking, mm-hmm. which is that women aren't funny. We have proven ourselves to be funny, so I will not continue to discuss that. And so I had promised her that there was no way, shape, or form that that's what this documentary is going to be about. And what I asked her was, why do you think that that even came into being? But she was really attuned to it, and so she just shut me down.
But it sounds like that is a question that women comedians, maybe not all of them, but many of them are very tired of sort of litigating and answering.
Exhausted.
It's so ridiculous.
Exhausted. And it's ridiculous. And come on, people, it's 2021. There are plenty of funny women that everybody can name. Let's get over that.
How are the comedians from this film that you've kept in touch with, how are they doing in this version of the world where they're really not able to get out and do stand-up comedy in clubs very much?
I think it's been incredibly hard. I think they've all found creative outlets in various ways. For a while there, Jessica Kirsten was like doing this Zoom bomb of people's Passovers, which was hysterical. But people have found different ways. Like a few people are now out at some outdoor venues. But I know that all of them have felt really sad. This is a place of connection for them. This is a place where their voices are allowed to come out, and to bottle them up like that, I think, has been hard, as we've all been suffering in our own in our own ways, being so isolated.
Do you have reason for optimism, having spent some time really immersed in this world of stand-up comedy, and particularly talking to women who perform stand-up comedy? Like, do you feel like things are moving in the right direction for both the women who are performing and the women who will come later to perform?
I really do. I feel a great deal of optimism about what's coming up for women in comedy, in part because of the Me Too movement and some strong self-awareness about exactly the ways that men have stifled women's voices in this field. And I also feel like there's a new generation of women who haven't been through everything that that this generation had, and come at it with a bit more force and energy. You know, they kind of stand on the shoulders of the women who came before them. So I'm excited for that.
Were you a stand-up comedy fan before this? I mean, you said that you were looking at it from a feminist perspective and as an interesting sort of performative thing, but have you now become like a fan of going to dank comedy clubs and watching people tell jokes into a microphone?
I cannot wait to go back. Yeah. I'm so excited. It's so cathartic, and I don't think we've had that kind of catharsis in a very long time.
Yes.
And we're desperate for
yes.
it, right?
Yes.
Well, Andrea Nevins, the film is great. It's hysterical. It's on FX. We highly recommend it. And we'll see you at a dank comedy club, hopefully in the near future.
I cannot wait.
That was Andrea Nevins right here on the Livewire House Party. You can check out her new documentary, Hysterical, on FX and Hulu right now. Hey, special thanks this episode to Will Fruworth, Portland, Oregon. Will is part of the Livewire member community and is generously supporting our show with a donation each month. And we are so thankful for that support, because it's how we're able to keep the show going. So a big thanks to Will for helping Livewire out. This is the Livewire House Party from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We're talking a lot about performance on the show this week, and live performance specifically. And so we thought it would be interesting to ask the Livewire listeners the question, what's the most memorable performance you have ever seen? Elena, what are folks saying?
Okay, here is one that is going to make me jealous for the rest of my life, from Brett. Second row seats for Prince, touring the album Controversy, so super early. And the opening act was Morris Day and the Time on a snowy February night in Minnesota.
Wow. That must have been an unforgettable night.
I bet it was 7 hours long.
I know we're not really here to answer these listener questions. This is their time. But I'd have to put, I saw Prince right towards the end of his life when he did a tour of very small venues. And my friend got tickets, and then she couldn't use them, so she sold them to me, and they were not cheap. And I acquired them, and the jury was out for me as to if this was a good use of money up until he played Purple Rain on a grand piano, and I just started bawling.
Oh my God.
It was like,
Don't even with me. kudos to Brett.
What's another memorable performance one of the Livewire listeners has seen?
Here's a non-concert one. Memorable, not best, is the hashtag. So that's what I'm setting you up for.
Okay.
From Tracy, I ended up at an improv show in Portland, and realized once we got there that we were the only people in the audience. The troupe kept asking for audience suggestions, and it was so, like, 8,000 O's. Oh, awkward. We wanted to leave, but we couldn't bring ourselves to do it. So memorable in a different way.
That is, well, I have a new stress dream plot line, yeah. Elena. Only attendee of an improv show is now, that's replacing, you know, roller coaster where the tracks are out up ahead.
Less scary.
Yeah, right. I take the roller coaster. Okay, one more quick one before we get our next guest out here.
Oh, I love this one from Hannah. I saw Richard III performed at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in high school. I went in thinking snooze fest, but I left speechless by how incredible it was, and I still talk about it. Yay, theater wins!
Yes, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. That's going to be that's going to be a happy day when that sort of stuff is happening again. Because, I mean, particularly if you grew up in the Northwest like I did, like, you make a pilgrimage down there. And, I mean, it really is eye-opening when you're, like, you know, in school to see this stuff performed at this level. I mean, it's a really amazing thing. All right, we are talking about performance this week on the show. And our next guest literally wrote the book on it, or at least a book on it, which comes out this week.
Yeah.
It's called A Little Devil in America, Notes on Praise of Black Performance. And Elena, it is such a good read, which of course should come as absolutely no surprise because it was written by Hanif Abdul-Raqib, who is a New York Times bestseller and is one of the more frequent LiveWire guests over the past few years. Hanif, welcome back to the LiveWire house party.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you all. I think this is the second time since the pandemic, the second time since being in our homes. So yeah.
You keep making all of this amazing stuff during the pandemic, Hanif, whether it's like podcasts or music blogs or now this book. So was there a particular performance, Hanif, that you saw or were thinking about that kind of sparked the idea in your mind for this book?
What's funny is this book, as it is completed, is not the book that it was as it started. I initially, inspired by a somewhat odd and intense trip to Memphis that sent me into this kind of existential crisis about appropriation and Black artists dying without receiving their proper due. I was thinking a lot about Isaac Hayes and Al Green. I wanted to write a book about minstrelsy and tie it to this history of appropriation and dislocating Black artists from their work. But as I was working on the book, I realized that taking that approach was doing this thing that was even unintentionally. See, to take that approach meant that I was centering whiteness, like because I kind of had to, you know, in order to tell some of the stories I was trying to tell. And I thought, well, that's not exactly fun for me at this stage of my, like, writing life, or not exciting for me. And I didn't want to write a book that felt hard. I wanted to write a book that felt exciting. And around the time that I was thinking about switching modes in the book, I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and they were like, casually, just very casually, like, I have this hard drive of Soul Train episodes, almost every episode from the 70s to the 80s. And they were like, that's all I heard. And they went on to ramble about, like, what they're trying to do with it. And I was like, no, send it to me. Like, I would love it. Like, you know, I'll pay you for it. I'll pay for shipping. Just send it to me. And I began watching hours of Soul Train, like, literal, like, hundreds of hours almost, had to be. And in that process, I think I tapped into the center of what became this book, which is, my hope is that it's celebratory and not only daunting or not only painful or not only historically intense, but also something that really seeps deep into this idea of celebration without any other pretense.
Well, that was, I mean, you talk about the Soul Train line in the book, which, as a kid growing up seeing Soul Train, I just thought, oh, this is a fun dance thing that's happening. But there's a lot of layers to it, particularly for the Black folks that were on Soul Train.
Yeah, and I mean, along with that, so I had no idea, you know, the essay that opens the book parallels these Soul Train lines to the Great Depression era dance marathons, which I had never heard of. I didn't even know those existed. And a friend of mine, different friend, he, like, you know, got me hip to them. And then he sent me a folder of photos from those dances, which I don't know if y'all have ever seen.
Yeah, they're nuts.
They are just like, they're like alarming. They're really jarring. they're kind of beautiful in a way. But like the whole circumstance of these marathons is like messed up. So I don't want to romanticize it too much. But I got so captivated by just the brutality yet gentleness of it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you hear dance contest, dance marathon. It just seems like people are going to do the flat foot flugie for 6 hours. And I mean, right. It was a way for people, as you write in the book, to just try to maybe get a little bit of money or put food on the table. I mean, it was grueling and very dangerous.
Yeah. And in some cases, one, people were dancing for like thousands of hours.
Mm-hmm. Months.
And in some cases, if you came in second, you got nothing. So if you danced for 1,457 hours, you won. You won a cash prize, all this stuff. If you danced for 1,456 hours and 57 seconds, you got nothing. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, of course, you know, you were sheltered for that time and fed for that time, but you were leaving empty-handed in terms of like prize money that could sustain you for a little bit longer. And there was something so horrifying about that to me, that it was very much a test of very literal endurance. You know, it wasn't like, it was like everyone else drops and you're the only one left. And so you're not moving towards a set time frame. You're moving towards everyone else's elimination. Mm-hmm. And to think about that and to contrast that with the kind of very different emotional tenor of the Soul Train line, both of them requiring partnering in a way that made me think a lot about what it is to be tethered to someone for either a long time or a short time. That really changed the scope of the book immediately. Like when I dove into those parallels, the book became a different book.
Could you read a little bit from the chapter 16 Ways of Looking at Blackface?
Yeah, this is from the essay in the book, 16 Ways of Looking at Blackface. This is section 7. When I say that Black performers used to wear blackface while performing in minstrel shows, I will not give you what you want. I will not give you the metaphor that ties it all to how easy it is to switch one's Black self into all the things America imagines but doesn't want. I will not talk about crows or blackbirds or feathers or wings. I have no image of a night sky and a row of white teeth. You've had enough metaphors, and I've got a sneaking suspicion that's how we got here in the first place. The we being you and I, reader, or the we being you and I, America. When performing in southern towns in the 1860s and 1870s, all Black minstrel troupes were forced to stay in character, even offstage, dressed in slave rags and smiling from ear to ear while being shot at by white audiences on their way out of town. But this was the only way for white people to take in what they came to view as real African-inspired dance, and not what had come to be seen as the imitations done by white dancers. Consume what you can never become, and then kill it before it continues to remind you. And so, none of us deserve the metaphor here, but to say that Black performers used to wear blackface when performing for white audiences, so that nothing but the movements of their feet might be present in the room. Everything else, too Black to be visible.
That's Hanif Abdul-Raqib reading from his new book, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. I think this is the third book of yours that I've read, and it seemed to me like it was the most personal. I felt like I learned the most about your growing up and your experience in the world. Is this your most personal book yet that you've written as far as including yourself in the writing?
That's so funny. I've heard that a lot. People have said that a lot, but this actually feels to me like one of my least personal. I mean, like, for me, it doesn't get much more personal than A Fortune for Your Disaster was.
The poems,
you know,
yeah.
Like, that was, even if people, I know it's poems, and there's, like, you know, the speaker in the poem and the person, but I think that book is, like, the veil is very thin. Mm-hmm. And I also think, and maybe this is just because of the emotional place I was in at the time of working on it, but I think that They Can't Kill Us is just a really personal book. Oh. It's weird because I'm sure if I spent time with this as other people did, I think the parts of this that are personal are way more honed than the other parts of, you know, I think like talking about my relationship with my brother at the end, for example, is a much more honed and thoughtful execution of the personal than I think I'd ever gotten in any other book. And so there's ways that I think the personal in this book is more visceral. But I do think that I hide behind a lot of just pure excitement for the telling of these stories.
Yeah, I think it must be something about the connection between like that significant emotion about the units of pop culture that you're talking about, and then the swinging away from research to provide just small
bits like doing the dozens on the bus, right? Or, you know, this is what it was like in the forest, you know, across the street from where I grew up.
Or moonwalking, you know, at a mosque.
Right.
Yeah, I do think if there is one thing I think I've grown as a writer, it is that kind of transferring registers in information delivery.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, I think in They Can't Kill Us, which is a book I still love and I'm proud of, obviously.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to pull back from like, here's my personal story and here's my personal life and here's a personal anecdote to offer some more concrete things. And even in Go Ahead in the Rain, I found myself wrestling with that. But this book, it came so easy to me to kind of shift the registers of information delivery where it's like I can really weave comfortably in and out of the heavily researched or trying to bring people to a place where they can visualize the thing that I visualized. And then occasionally nudge them to remind them that this is a real person telling the story.
Mm-hmm. You dedicate this book to Josephine Baker. Why did you choose her?
You know, I was going to... Well, I love Josephine Baker a great deal. The title comes from Josephine Baker. It's a fragment of a longer sentiment from her speech on the March of Washington. I was going to dedicate the book to Miss Toni Morrison, who I love a great deal and who just means... I mean, people who know my work a little bit know how much Miss Morrison means to me, but I felt so conflicted. You know, I was like, what if this is, hopefully this is not the best work I will ever do. And I don't know if I want to have Toni Morrison's name there in that case.
I never thought of that, the implications of the book dedication. Yeah. And if that's
and I good. Say that, I say that as someone who believes that this is the best book I've ever written, like truly. And the book I feel very good about, but I was still like, but I hope, you know, I'm still in my 30s. Like, I hope this isn't it for me. but Josephine Baker is so important, but also to not take anything away from Josephine Baker, she's so important to the engine of this book. Not just the title and not even just the essay on her, but this idea of honoring a full life. Josephine Baker's full life often does not get you know, she gets categorized by this era of her life. Mm-hmm. And you know what's so fascinating to me is that you can go on YouTube and watch 50 years worth of Josephine Baker performances. Mm. Like there's footage from 1925 and there's footage from her final shows in the mid-70s. Wow. And there's footage of everything in between. And that is remarkable to me. Like I can't believe that there's this much of an archive by a single performer. And I found myself so much more fascinated by the performances when she was a little older, like performing in Paris in the 70s, where she couldn't move as well, but she still had impeccable crowd control. Just with her voice and her tone and her, like, you know, her small move, her outfits. And so, you know, I was thinking about the celebration of a full life and not just the most scandalous parts or not the parts where someone is at their most mobile and capable of serving an audience. But Josephine Baker, who showed up to the March on Washington in the uniform of the French Resistance and spoke, you know, like that was, there was a real propulsion that I found in the life of Josephine Baker that brought me to the book. And so that was my way of showing some small gratitude.
The last chapter of the book is sort of dedicated or centered around a punk band, F.U. Pay Us. I'm wondering why that's where you kind of wanted to land this flight and why that band was important to you.
I love that band. You know, they're not as active as they once were and their window was kind of small, and their members have done a great many other things. But I wanted to write about rage again. So I think if They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, I wrote an essay about Black rage. But I didn't, you know, if I go back and read it now, I often think, gosh, I would have done some things differently. And then when I saw that show, the F.U. Pay Us show, and I saw how quickly rage was transmitted into love, or how quickly rage and love were two vehicles kind of on the same, you know, on the same highway, just sharing the same lane simultaneously, it really unlocked something for me in the understanding of what drives me to stay in Columbus, what drives me to organize in Columbus, what drives me to be among the people in Columbus and not separate or build a hierarchy around my presence here, any of that stuff. And I wanted to kind of return to this idea of rage as I learned through that show and as I learned through that group.
This is probably an impossible question to answer or maybe a little bit reductive, but I just wanted, is there an overarching statement that you're hoping to make with this book about, Black performance in this country in particular and how it should be thought of, how it should be regarded?
Not really, only because I don't want to be prescriptive, mm-hmm. but I mostly wanted to write a book where the praise was too large. You know, I wanted to write a book where praise and joy was centered and immovable. Mm-hmm. And that was it. You know, I'm not trying to, I cannot correct the course of America. And I don't know if I have much interest in it, honestly. All of our time here is limited. And I am not going to be the person who corrects the course of America's mess. But I think what I can do is say, gosh, like, isn't Mary Clayton wonderful? You know, like, shouldn't we return to more than just the one Mary Clayton performance that has been pushed upon us for a long time? Or I can say, like, isn't playing a game of spades like a performance?
Oh, I love that essay.
These kind of things.
Well, Hanif, this book is really just an amazing piece of work and was so fun to read. It really is celebratory. It really is joyous, even though it also describes an experience that at times can be very painful. So congratulations on this book. It's really incredible.
Thanks. It's always good to talk to y'all, too. It's you know, we're here again in our homes.
Yeah.
Catching up.
Yeah. Fingers crossed that the next time we talk to you. We're not like our first three-time guest during a lockdown.
Let's come back whenever you want, but you know.
Yeah. That was Hanif Abdur-Raqib right here on the Livewire House Party. His new book, which just comes out this week, is A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. This is the Livewire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarella. We got to take a quick break, but do not go anywhere because when we come back, we are going to be hearing from one of our very favorite performers, none other than Shaky Graves is going to swing by. So stay with us. It's Livewire. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. And they make one-of-a-kind handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to the LiveWire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We've been talking about performances on the show this week, and our next guest's first taste of performing in the public eye came by way of acting roles in Friday Night Lights and the Spy Kids franchise. That was all before he sort of really focused on music full time. He's now celebrating the 10th anniversary of his breakout debut. It was the album Roll the Bones. Please welcome Alejandro Rose Garcia, also known as Shaky Graves, to the Livewire House Party.
Oh, it's good to be home.
Yeah, man. The last time we saw you was we were doing a cookout in my backyard in the summer, and you were kind enough to join us and play a song. This was during the pandemic already. How have you been doing since then?
I've been doing good. How has your tofu grilling advanced? I feel like you were melting, strange objects on a grill.
Yeah, I was. I came in for a lot of, I think, well-founded criticism about my grilling skills because I was grilling up a bunch of kind of plant-based products, which were not turning out the way I hoped. How's life in Austin been for you?
It's been wild. It's been a roller coaster. It's a part action movie, you know. did you ever see The Day After Tomorrow with Jake Gyllenhaal? You know,
oh, yeah. it's a little
like that, like roaming wolves, kind of ice tornado one day. And then like, it's the most beautiful day outside right now. Yesterday, it was like oppressively hot. It's a very melodramatic state that I live in.
Yeah. And also Austin is a city that really thrives on the sort of energy of like live music events. And like, that's not been really going on all that much. Have you kind of adapted your style a little bit during the pandemic in terms of like how you're performing? I know you've got like virtual shows coming up and things like that? Like, are you getting kind of used to this way of performing?
This is kind of the, this is going back to an older model, because I still feel like I spent a lot of time just not having shows and recording in my house. I spent a lot of time just tinkering, and then that turned into other stuff. So it's, I've gotten to go back to basics, and now, you know, there's a few more moving elements, like the being good at Zoom, which I don't think I still am good at Zoom right now. I'm doing this on two different, we're figuring this out as we go along, but yeah, I've been doing some live streams, which is a strange experience. But it does also feel like early shows where you play to four disinterested people, except they all have cameras pointed at you this time.
Right.
But they're being paid to be there. So it's a little weirder, but, you know, it's nice.
Well, speaking of your earlier days, I know that you're releasing a Roll the Bones 10.
Yeah.
Which is a re-release of your album Roll the Bones that was this like a kind of phenomenon. What were your expectations a decade ago when you were putting that album out the first time?
Oh, man. I don't even know. I'm kind of catching up because for this record, I got to go back and look at like old journal entries. Mm. And it's nice. It's like a lot of my more realistic and kind of far-fetched dreams have come true in the 10-year interim. And I think most of it was that I just kind of wanted people to actually hear my music. And if I was like, man, if one person really enjoyed this, like I'd be made in the shade. So I did it. I'm retired now. It's great. We did. I reached that one person. And you know, it's like those dark nights of the soul where you start to get down on your head. You're like, what do I even do in life? You know, like this has been sort of a great moment to count my blessings and be like, wow, I've gotten to travel. Cause at the point when I wrote this record, I was kind of trapped. I was living in LA trying desperately to be an actor, which meant just walking into room after room, and shaving my face daily, which I hate doing, and being like, hello, my name is Alejandro Rose Garcia and I'm reading for Brad, the boyfriend. And,
right.
And they'd be like, no. And I'd be like, thank you. And then I would leave and I'd go into the next room and be like, please, I'm hungry. Like, I'm reading for Chad, the boyfriend. They're like, no. You didn't. I was like, okay, thank you.
I didn't know this about your career trajectory, that you had this other life where you're trying to be a working actor, where you're trying to be Chad, the boyfriend.
That's the exact way to say it. Working to be a working actor is exactly right. Yeah, I mean, I grew up doing theater and performance, and my mom is a playwright, and my dad's a set and light designer for theater, or was at that point. And so I grew up around all that and just have always loved the performing arc, you know? So I just kind of went for it. I just like, oh my God, hold on.
It's your agent. They want you back in LA. You finally booked it.
What's that event? Avengers 9? Oh, wow. Yeah, I would love to play Iron Man. Okay.
I have a friend in LA who books like, who's an actor, and they book like one, you know, sort of commercial a year that kind of funds the rest of their existence. And
yeah,
they said they're a professional auditioner. That's their job is auditioning. Yeah. And then, you know, about once a year, they actually go play the guy in the prescription drug ad who's hot air ballooning despite his infection or whatever's going on.
It felt a lot like having like a gambling addiction, you know, where every day you're like, today's the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Daddy's feeling hot. You know, like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times where I was just like, I just crushed that. I did so good. And they were just like, no, you didn't. I'm like, oh. Or like, yeah, we actually already booked this person. We were just seeing the rest of it. Or like, we were just thinking maybe he wouldn't be blonde. But after seeing you, we decided, yeah, he's definitely blonde. So, you know, and you're just like, thanks.
Well, acting's loss is music's gain.
Amen.
Alejandro, we have to say that. This week on the show, we're talking a lot about performance. And we asked the LiveWire listeners, what is the most memorable performance they've seen? I'm kind of just springing this on you, but is there a particularly memorable performance that you can think of, like as a fan or as a music appreciator?
Yeah, I saw Diane Tward at a at a festival that I adored that ended. Oh, that you guys, you're up there. Did you ever go to Sasquatch or hear of Sasquatch?
Yeah, totally. Sure.
Their performance was so scary, for lack of a better word. It was the late show too, so it was like after everyone had been out all day long. like, you know, eating illicit substances and drinking in the sun. And they're like, oh, man, everyone doesn't want to go back to their like weird campsite or whatever. Like, oh, there's one more show. And the DJ came out in this ghoul mask and proceeded to say the longest stream of like super creative, really harsh obscenities that I've ever heard strung together just perfectly, just like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And it basically worked as this wild filter where anybody that was tripping too hard or like couldn't handle it left immediately. They were like throngs of people like, no, give it, no. And then everybody, like me, I was like, what is going on? And then people started to get closer and Ninja, the front man, jumped in the audience after like two songs. And they started with all this clothing on and they just kept losing clothing throughout until they were both in their underwear at the end. And I was just like, this is the most compelling. I mean, it was, talk about theater people. I was right. Like, you guys are definitely theater people. This is insane.
What are you looking forward to about live performances in rooms with an audience, Alejandro?
I mean, I'd say experiences like that. As someone who can get a little on the jaded side because I do this all the time. I still, you know, there's those moments that the kind of ferocious nature of a show you don't expect, or you go to see a really hectic show and it's just like a room of people smashing each other. You know, that kind of stuff is hard to recreate mm-hmm. on Zoom or, you know, via computers. And I'm kind of grateful for the scaling back of stuff because I feel like a lot of times people just want to be in a room. Like, I would really love to just like sit down and talk to like David Byrne for an hour. He doesn't even have to play music, you know, but I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, I'll go see your show. But I really just want to like hang out with whoever I want to hear play music often. Mm-hmm. And so I think these days, as things start to open up again, I think there might be a good opportunity to still be like, well, let's just keep it more intimate and have better shows sometimes.
Right.
It's not mm-hmm. gonna scratch the itch of wanting to like crowd surf, you know, at the Palladium or something like that.
Well, Alejandro, I see you've got your guitar there and your fancy microphone set up. So as to play us a song, what were you gonna play for us?
I mean, I figured it'd be fitting to play Roll the Bones, right?
It's nice.
The title track. I did a version of this in 2013 for a thing called Audio Tree. And that's the first thing that a lot of people have seen of my music.
Yeah, that's a really memorable video.
Thank you. But a lot of people don't know that there is an original recording of it that was off of this thing. So when I re-released it and kind of like was like, oh, I'm putting this, re-releasing this album, I made a video for it. And people were like, yeah, I dig the remix, but like, I really like, really like the original. And I'm like, this is the original. So this is going to be somewhat in between them.
Okay, right on. This is Shaky Graves on the Livewire House Party.
Yes, so it goes. boys in country clothes. Yeah, let's take a chance, so enroll the bones. Yeah, go crash your car, burn down your home. Yeah, and try to fuck it all, them enemies and dead, so they'll just chase you around and give you sour dreams. Yeah, try to forget all them enemies and debts, they'll just chase you around and give you sour dreams. Or so it seems.
That was Shaky Graves right here on the Livewire House Party. We love that guy. The 10th anniversary edition of his debut album, Roll the Bones, is out now. And if you'd like to hear more of our conversation with Alejandro, which was super fun, you can check out a longer version on our podcast by going to livewireradio.org or check in wherever you get your podcasts. All right, before we get out of here this week, a little preview of next week's show. It is National Poetry Month, so we're going to talk to some of the most interesting poets working right now, including Franny Choi and Roger Reeves. We are also going to hear an incredible collaboration with the poet Derek C. Brown and the band Helio Sequence, and we are going to be looking to get the listeners' answers to our listener question, which is what this coming week, Elena?
Little creative writing assignment. Please write us a haiku. Well, maybe don't write us a haiku. Write yourself a haiku and send it to us.
What are the parameters of haiku? Do you know this off the top of your head?
Yep. 5-7-5. So a 5-syllable line, a 7-syllable line, and a 5-syllable line. And if you want to get super technical, you're supposed to mention nature in some way, but no, most people don't.
Okay. We'll take a kind of generous interpretation of haiku. Just get close. Get as close as you can.
Yeah.
As a trained poet, and send in your haiku to us by way of Twitter or Facebook or even Instagram. We are at Livewire Radio. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Livewire House Party. A huge thanks to our guests, Hanif Abdur-Rakib, Andrea Nevins, and Shaky Graves. Livewire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. Tim Harkins is our production director. Our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. And Ariana Donneville is our social media manager. Our music is composed by A. Walker Spring. Molly Pettit is our technical director and mixer.
Additional funding provided by the Oregon Arts Commission, a state agency funded by the state of Oregon and the National Endowment for the Arts. Livewire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank member Roger Meyer of Beaverton, Oregon. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, visit livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank. For Elena Passarello and the whole Livewire crew, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of Livewire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the Livewire podcast feed, and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app, and bam, you are Livewire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about Livewire. And thank you.
From PRF.